Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. And in this episode, I'll discuss the longest cyber operation ever, the FBI's Innocent Images Initiative, with its initial case agent and current FireEye executive, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Doris Gardner. But before I get to Doris, let's look at a few quick cyber news items. First one has to do with your printer. So should you worry about your printer? Well, if you have a network printer, absolutely you should. So most printers today now are networked in some way, shape, or form, either connected to your wireless network or connected by a wire or an Ethernet cable directly into your network. And so as a result of that, because of how advanced they now are, there is certainly an issue with hackers potentially being able to exploit vulnerabilities within those printers and then compromise the printer itself, get information on what it is you're printing, and then potentially pivot off of that printer into your network if they can find other vulnerabilities with connections that particular printer has. Obviously, the improvements made with printers make blending our physical and digital lives easier and sadly more accessible than ever. But they also create potential access points again, that hackers can insert malicious code and do a lot of bad things. So how do you deal with this? Well, the key thing is just keep your printers updated. Run software on your home computer that reaches out to check for updates. And if there's an update for your printer, update it. That update exists because there's some vulnerability within your printer that they are trying to correct. So go in and make sure you make those updates. If for businesses, there's a lot of high-tech printers within corporations, hopefully your IT staff is keeping your network printers up to date. I can't guarantee whether they are or not. If you're a small company, chances are that's the last thing they're worrying about. You may want to just mention to them, hey, you know, is the printer updated? We want to make sure it doesn't get hacked. Another key thing is with 3D printers. A lot of companies are using 3D printers to map out and create items associated with their business. The information of those particular things being printed are in the memory of the 3D printer. So you want to make sure that you, again, have the printers updated. Ideally, once you've printed what you need, you should remove it from memory if you can, so it doesn't stand there. Because if someone gets into your 3D printer, they can pull all of your designs off and they could basically recreate what you have. So be aware of the particular risks or the threats associated there with printing. Not saying don't use printers, obviously. Again, just be aware of it and keep your system safe by making sure your printers stay updated. The second thing I want to talk about very briefly is holiday scams. This week is Thanksgiving week, and so there are going to be a slew of holiday scams that come forth from now till Christmas time. I'm actually going to do a podcast with Scott Angenbaum later this week that discusses this in more detail, but I just want to talk about a couple key things. This is more of a 5,000-foot view on holiday shopping and how to stay safe. So these are just things to be aware of, and I want to give a hat tip to LifeLock. I actually got this off their webpage. This is not my own creation, so it's a couple of things that they mentioned that's very key. So the key thing, a couple of key things just to keep in mind, and again, I'm going to go into more depth on a podcast later this week, and you can listen to that one. But when you ship your product, if you buy stuff online, ship it to a secure location. Don't bring it, send it to your house unless you know you're going to be there. With UPS and FedEx, you can redirect your shipments to a local store and go pick up the store there. I know with FedEx, you can ship them to Walgreens, pick them up at a Walgreens or pick them up at a FedEx facility. Same thing with UPS. You can have them hold it and you go actually physically pick it up. Because the problem here is not a cyber problem. It's a physical problem where if you have stuff that just gets dropped off at your front door, there are porch pirates all over the country that are looking to take items off of porches. You're going to see a lot of news articles with people with their Ring cameras showing people stealing their stuff off of their front stoop that they can't really do much about. I mean, every once in a while you might get the license plate, which is great, but for the most part, you're not going to get your stuff back. Use official retailer apps to shop. In other words, if you're shopping at Target, use the Target app or the Target website or Walmart or what have you. Use the official apps. Don't use some kind of special app that promises to bring all the information from all of these stores into one app so you don't have to have multiple apps. That is just a recipe for theft. They're going to steal your login information, your credit card information, all that kind of stuff. Don't save your credit card information on your accounts. If your Target account gets compromised and you have your credit card saved, they can use that information to ship stuff to themselves. I know it's easy to store that information on the website so you'd have it for easy use down the line, but it's a risk that you have out there because you are making that available to anyone who compromises your accounts. And this brings up, obviously, passwords. Make sure you have different passwords for different apps and different websites that you may be shopping from so that if one gets compromised, they don't have access to all of your accounts. I know this is a pain in the butt to have multiple passwords, but there are password managers that you can put on your phone or put on your computer or put on your iPad that make it very easy for you to create strong passwords and to store those passwords for easy use. I've mentioned this many, many times, so I'm something you've heard me say a lot. And if you are shopping on public Wi-Fi, don't do it unless you have a VPN. If you have a VPN on your device that you are shopping from using local Wi-Fi, like at Starbucks or McDonald's or Chick-fil-A, if you do not use a VPN, all your data is in clear text that anyone on that network has the potential to pull and use because they have your information now. So if you have a VPN, it encrypts your data, makes it very hard for them to do anything with that. Last thing I will say, no retailer is going to ask you for your social security number, so don't give it out. Now, the one thing I will note on this is chances are your social security number has been compromised somewhere else anyway, so it's already available, but no reason to make it more available by putting it out there. So those are just a couple things. There's a lot more I could go on. Go to LifeLock. They have a really good website on this that goes into more detail on these things and a lot of other things that would take up a whole episode on itself. But go check those out. And as you go through the shopping season, make sure you shop safe and keep your information private. Well, I want to welcome to the program. The one person when I put this podcast together, the one person I wanted to make sure I had on first, although it took 14 episodes to finally get to her, was the best boss I ever had in the FBI and also my first boss in the Charlotte field office, Doris Gardner. Doris currently is a senior executive with FireEye, and we'll talk about what she does in that role later on in the podcast. But Doris, thank you for coming on the podcast. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Darren. It is indeed a pleasure to join you today and to catch up with you. So very nice.
Yes, time. Before we recorded, we were just talking about how old we feel. So that was good. We won't talk about that here, but that was some good catching up. But so let's start with your career arc. What were you doing before the FBI and what made you decide to become a special agent?
So before I joined the Bureau, I was a student. I was working on my master's degree, and I was working at my undergraduate college. And I ran into a fellow student in the same degree program as I did in the hallway at my undergrad, and he was there checking grades for an FBI background investigation. And he said, "Hey, what are you going to do when you finish your master's at Wake?" And I said, "Well, I think I'm going to teach." He goes, "Oh, no. Come to FBI headquarters with me in D.C. Let me introduce you to some folks." So I did. I went to D.C. I met with some of the computer scientists at FBI headquarters, and I applied, and I got the job. So it's really interesting timing. I had my orals to defend my thesis on a Friday. The next Monday, I was supposed to start at FBI headquarters as a computer scientist.
And what was your major at Wake, if I may ask?
Was it theoretical mathematics?
Oh, well, okay.
Good times.
So before we're done, I'll have you map out pi to the 75th digit, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
I was a computer scientist at FBI headquarters for almost 4 years. I worked on a lot of interesting cases while developing some of the programs and software for the field use as well as headquarters use. And I'm thinking, man, I would love to be asking the bad guys these questions. And I said, I want to be an agent. So 4 years after joining the Bureau, I became an FBI agent. My first office of assignment was Baltimore, and loved it. I worked initially for just a few months in headquarters city in Baltimore, and then I was assigned to a resident agency in Hyattsville, Maryland, which is down in PG County. And we covered, in RRA, we covered bank robberies, drugs, violent crime acts, and from that assignment, I went to FBI headquarters for a couple years, 2.5 years actually, and then down to Charlotte, where I was the cybercrime supervisor.
So let's step, let's step back to Baltimore for a minute, because obviously, so this was the early to mid 90s, correct? In your time in Baltimore?
Yes. Yeah.
So
yes.
What did cyber look like for the FBI at that time? My guess is they didn't know how to spell it yet. They didn't know how to wrap their arms around it. And what did that look like?
So cyber was very new. It was in its infancy at the time. We had, I think, only one headquarters supervisor in the white collar crime section. So it wasn't even thought to be an its own entity, section, unit, anything. It was one guy. And the card exam unit was three people for the whole bureau.
Okay.
So it was very new. And we didn't have very many cyber cases, because the internet was just taken off as I found in the early 90s. The biggest provider was America Online, and it was growing by leaps and bounds at that time. But very small origin.
Right. So if I remember this correctly, you were the first case agent for Innocent Images, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So Innocent Images.
I wrote the first undercover.
Right. So Innocent Images, for those who don't know what it is probably the longest running FBI national initiative, because it still carries on today in a variety of forms. But it was originally basically targeting online distributors of child pornography. So how did you get started with that? What was the impetus for it? And we'll kind of talk through that, because I think it's interesting that it still continues on in almost every field office still has something resembling Innocent Images. But what got you involved in that? How'd you come up with the name? That's always an interesting story. But so talk a little bit about how you got to Innocent Images and you made it what it was.
So the origin of the case was a kidnapping, actually. We had a 10-year-old boy just suddenly go missing in a neighborhood around dusk one day in Brentwood, Maryland. This was in 1993. He was supposed to be going home from school on his red bicycle, and he and his bicycle both just disappeared. So all hands on deck. At that time, I was on the white collar squad in Baltimore. Again, I was their cyber agent, but we didn't have any cyber cases. And being the new kid, they sent me down to Hyattsville to work on this. So, you know, we were doing neighborhood investigation, knocking on doors, asking about suspicious activities. Had they seen the little boy, Junior, and trying to determine who saw him last, and was there anybody, any cars that might have picked him up, thrown his bicycle in the back of a pickup truck or something like that. And when we when we did this and started asking about suspicious people, we uncovered a couple of pedophiles. And they were running the old bulletin board system and buying computers and other gifts for boys in the neighborhood. And then they'd give them a computer, and then they would set up a way to communicate with them unbeknownst to their parents. And they'd set up meetings and for sexual encounters. So my focus was on those computers that we were able to seize when we executed search warrants at their houses. But we didn't find Junior Brudinski, the 10-year-old boy went missing. But I took those computers down to the three-person cart unit, and they printed out the evidence for me. Mm-hmm. And I would go through printouts, Darren, and highlight and use sticky notes. And so we were able to find a network of others that they were sharing images with. We also found those two to have produced videos of their sexual acts with these underage boys in the 8 to 10 year old range. Then I got a call by a Florida Department of Law Enforcement agent about a case he had started involving a pedophile, because he had heard that I was working on a case in Baltimore. So I connected with him. And his case involved a New Hampshire man who would hit. He liked boys, but he had daughters. So he had hit on his daughter's boyfriends. So we executed a search warrant at his place, and he was trading his child pornography and meeting other boys online through AOL. So my first search warrant at AOL was a child pornography case. So when I executed that search warrant at America Online, or on his email account and his chat, it just exploded potentially with the number of subjects that were trading in child pornography. And so I wrote a small undercover operation at the time in 1993. I finally got it approved in 94. And we had agents go online and pretend to be young children, 6, 7, 10, 12 years old. And you would be surprised how many older men would hit on those kids through chat and email. And it provided, AOL provided the chat rooms for these pedophiles to meet and find each other, unlike anything before in the physical world. Mm-hmm. And
was AOL surprised that this was going on, or were they kind of aware of it and just didn't care? Or they just didn't have, they just created this community and didn't really have the capability to monitor all the activity going on in it?
Initially, they were surprised. But then when I kept coming with search warrants, they kind of got the message. And we had a group that we couldn't penetrate with an undercover. So I wrote a application for a Title III, or, full content intercept of email and chat at America Online. And that required them to have to do extra coding. They'd never had a request like that. So it was a learning experience for them. And, they pushed back. They wouldn't do any coding until I showed up with a court order. say, okay, you got to figure out how to get me this. But it worked out. And we were able to collect some of the most horrific pornography I'd ever seen through the wiretap. And these guys, not only were they really private and wouldn't allow anybody that they didn't know into the group, they would encrypt their child pornography with PGP.
Wow.
So
that's an impressive technique in 1994.
It is. It really is. We had to learn as we went along. I'm like, PGP, what's that? I had to learn all about it. And then I went to Quantico and I said, how do I get these keys? I can't open this stuff. So they helped me out. And, we were able to do some a lot of firsts with innocent images, like the Title III on an email box that had never been done before. The search warrants on a box, like we wanted them to leave the box open so we could continue to collect the emails, even if we'd made an arrest, so we could get their co-conspirators. And that was a separate court order, an All Writs Act order, actually. And I was working with the top attorneys in DOJ. The guy who wrote the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act was who I worked with on a daily basis, because this was new for justice too. Mm-hmm. So it was just the internet getting started, and criminal activity followed as soon as it got going.
Well, I guess it's probably a good thing at that time that they didn't really have caller ID on phones, because my guess is when AOL would see your name pop up, they would say, who wants this one? Who's taking this? I don't want to talk to
them. Exactly.
And how long did it take before they offered you a job?
Not too long, but after they figured out, hey, we gotta try and police this and work on this issue, they were looking for experts in the field, and there weren't a lot back then.
Right. So here's an interesting question, and this may be more inside baseball for you and me, but who was your program manager? Who was running this particular operation? How confused were they when you brought it to them saying, hey, here's what I'm looking to do? Although I will say, probably from this perspective, it's the crime is understandable. I mean, you can understand what the crime is, so it's very easy to explain, here's why we need to do this. But I got to believe that the whole cyber piece of it, trying to do Title IIIs online and searching emails and all that, had to cause some heads to spin at headquarters.
Oh my goodness. Well, at the time, child pornography and child exploitation was in the violent crime unit. And, those folks were known as the knuckle draggers. right? They're the ones that had the hardcore stuff, bank robberies and extortions and stuff like that. They were the real deal FBI agent. And to throw a computer in front of them and say cyber and Title III on an email box, they just wouldn't get it. So my SSA at headquarters, I had to spend a lot of time. Thank God I was nearby. It was just in PG County. I could run down to headquarters and brief them, or they could come out to the RA and I could do the briefing there. But to educate them on what this undercover meant. You know, here's why I need this undercover operation. Here's how the email works. Here's how we will do a Title III with at America Online. And it was education every step of the way because, again, they had no clue what we were doing.
And when did headquarters take over and make it a national initiative where they were able to pass it out as a what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like here's a pre-made undercover that any office can do locally to try to combat the child pornography problem?
So we ran, as long as I was in Baltimore, we ran the national initiative. We were like a little piece of headquarters just for this case.
Yep.
So it was all under one case. We created subfiles for every subject, and then we sent those out as leads to the offices and let them prosecute. We would write the affidavit and they could just fill in the part for the local part, as you know, description of where the place was and the background on the individual and stuff like that. At any phone records or power records, anything that they would do that. So the case was just handed to them basically on a platter. They just need to fill in a few blanks. So we did that as long as I was in Baltimore. We ran it because violent crime could not do it. They just didn't have the knowledge of how to do this and do it quickly. So we managed it for a number of years. I left Baltimore in 1997, went to headquarters, and it was still being run at the field office. So I, you know, other field offices saw what we were doing and wanted to replicate the undercover because they were working on task forces with state and local people to combat this sexual exploitation, child pornography. So at that point, we started just, you know, giving them a template for what an undercover would look like. And I can't tell you the year headquarters just started approving those for different other field offices other than Baltimore.
Gotcha.
They were very cautious at rolling it out because it was so new and we didn't want to make any mistakes to make bad law.
Right. So how did it impact the undercover agents? Because I know that, so when I ultimately ended up running a squad in Cleveland, we had a guy who oversaw the innocent images stuff, but he had to look at a lot of images all the time as he did his prosecution. And I know that he had to go yearly to what in the FBI is called safeguarding. You talk to a psychologist and they do some tests to make sure that the case you're doing is not causing you mental issues. But how did that, for the first group of guys that had to, or guys and ladies that had to do that, how did it impact them? Did they volunteer to do it? Did they get dragged into it? What was the undercover operators who did that? How did they come to you?
So it was a reach out from us because for the first couple of years, we didn't do the testing because we were so busy just getting it off the ground and getting everything in place and the evidence collection and tracking for each field office. Because when we first did the first takedown of this case, we did 116 search warrants across the U.S. all simultaneously. So we were getting everything packaged up and ready for all of these field offices to go take these folks down. Now, unless there was a child that we feared was in danger, we would go ahead and do that one. But we did 116 collectively together. And after we did the first takedown, we had a little bit of time to do a review of what we had done and what issues that we thought we needed to address. And that was one of them, is that we have undercovers looking at children being sexually abused and put in dog cages and all different kinds of objects used against them. And so we thought, you know, this is hard to look at for a period of time. So we called headquarters and they said, okay, yeah, we agree with you. We need to watch our undercovers and see how they're doing mentally and emotionally. And so that's when we started. At first, we had a few that said, you know, I'm fine. Big tough agents. I'm fine. I don't need this. It's not affecting me. I'm doing my job. I'm putting these bad guys away. But everybody had to do it. It was mandatory. So I think it was a good thing, and it became more positive as more and more agents went through it. And we even instituted a rotation off the squad after a certain amount of time because it was so hard to look at.
Gotcha. So the undercover world for the FBI, you have to go through 2 weeks of training to become an undercover agent. Did you get a waiver on that so you could have only online undercovers, or did you have to take in full blown undercover agents who were qualified through the UC class and stuff like that?
Nope, this was brand new. No training. Yeah, figure it out on your own.
That's the best part. That's the best way to go. That's like as I would come to find out, if no one knew what you were talking about, you'd get stuff passed. It was fantastic. So Innocent Images, I understand, still goes today. So that's got to be the most effective FBI undercover probably ever. And ironically, so it's funny because you said it was, you know, program managed initially from headquarters on the violent crime unit. And ultimately it went to a cyber division unit that handled it. And now we've gone full circle and it's back on the violent crime group.
Yeah.
It's all criminal agents. So it's kind of funny how the world spins like that. But chances are in 5 years we'll be back on a cyber squad somewhere. But so you did all that successful. Did you get drafted to headquarters, or did you say, hey, it's time for me to go to headquarters? Because that's always an interesting point, because, you know, you can either say, hey, I want to move up. I want to be in management. Or, you know, you can get drafted. Someone says, hey, I think you'd be great in this role. Come on over. And at the time in 97, you said there's no cyber division in 97. So I'm sure you're fully ensconced in the cyber world at this point. What did you go to headquarters to do?
You are right. There wasn't many options to go to headquarters. I wasn't a violent crime per se agent. I got stuck with this kidnapping and then the pedophiles, you know, and so I immediately got pigeonholed into the Innocent Images arena. And my background, my undergraduate degree is in math and computer science. I went to headquarters as a computer scientist, my mathematical master's degree. You know, I was not a Vic Mo kind of person, right? But I did work bank robberies, and I worked with the locals, and that was fine too. It was a lot of fun. And I worked with our drug squad, and we did jump outs and all kinds of good stuff. But those were good days. So I loved the Bureau, loved what I was doing, but my goal was to get back to the Charlotte Division, which is home for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I can't get there from Baltimore. And Baltimore treated me extremely well. I was, because of Innocent Images and you know, what I was doing for these children, I was the queen, man. I could do, you know, whatever. I was doing new things. I was breaking new ground with Title IIIs and surreptitious entries and capturing PGP keys. I mean, DOJ loved it, FBI headquarters loved it, and Baltimore loved it. I got a new car every year. I mean, I was the queen, man.
Sure, yeah.
So I talked to my SAC. I said, I want to go to headquarters. And he goes, why? We treat you so well. And I'm like, yes, you do. But I can't get to Charlotte from Baltimore. So I said, I really want to go to headquarters and be a supervisor, and then hopefully I can get to Charlotte.
That's funny. It's funny so, you say that. That's funny you say that, because that's the one thing I forgot to mention. That's the other reason people go to headquarters, to get somewhere else, because that's the only way you can really do it. Yeah,
that's right.
Yep.
Yep. So I went to headquarters, and he said, you know, you're not going to ever get to Charlotte. You can't get to Charlotte. Charlotte's like one of the top offices in the Bureau to get to, and you're not going to get there. So I'm like, I got to try. So I applied for a job in what's called the National Infrastructure Protection Center. It was, again, very, very new. I was the second supervisor to get into NIPSE by just about a week. So there were just two of us to start. It was part of the National Security Division, but the National Infrastructure Protection Center was stood up under Bill Clinton to protect the critical infrastructures of the U.S., specifically the cyber portion of those. And it came out of Presidential Decision Directive 63, PDD 63. We kept quoting that all the time at headquarters. Mm-hmm. They're like, who are you? Well, we were created because of PDD 63. But we were part of the National Security Division, but cyber crime and cyber cases had started to kind of take off a little bit. At that time, we had three cyber squads in the whole bureau. We had New York, San Francisco, and WFO. And so, you know, it didn't take a lot of supervisors at headquarters to manage that. But then we started to expand the number of squads because cases started to increase as more and more providers got stood up and more and more criminals migrated to the internet. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting time to watch because we were setting up a brand new section in headquarters, you know, getting all the files set up, the admin stuff and educating the field. Okay, here's how we can help you for those few offices. And then we had to create justification for new squads in the field to expand this. Well, as one of the first two supervisors at the NIPSI, as it's called, I got to help determine which offices needed a squad. And
I wonder who gets one.
And had to justify why that office would need one. And so I did a lot of research in North Carolina. I did a lot of research in Georgia because Atlanta's a big office. Charlotte wasn't a big office. It's a medium-sized office. And I saw the potential and some existing cybercrime going on in both those divisions. And I thought they needed a squad. So fortunately, others thought the same way, and Charlotte got a squad, and Atlanta got a squad. Atlanta posted their position first. And I didn't want to get to Southeast. I'm like, oh, my goodness. So I called the Charlotte office, and I'm like, you guys have this new supervisory position. Are you going to post it anytime soon? And they said, well, yeah, we just hadn't got around to it. I'm like, well, okay. Can I help you in any way?
Right, yeah. Need the wording for that posting?
So anyway, I did talk to Atlanta because they were recruiting me really hard. Had a good relationship in Atlanta field office. And I said, you know, really, you know, if I can't go to Charlotte, I want you guys, but you guys are ahead of Charlotte. And I'm like, I'm going to wait for Charlotte. So I waited and I knew it was a long shot, but Charlotte finally posted and I applied and moon, sun, and stars all lined up just perfect. And I did get that supervisory job at Charlotte division. So I made sure to call my Baltimore SIC.
Yeah, you were still the queen. Come on now.
I called my Baltimore SAC and said, I made it.
So I have to ask this question. Who came up with the name National Infrastructure Protection Center? Did they become an SESer? I assume they did. But I mean, because this was always the joke I would tell when I would do presentations, talk about my career. So I was fortunate enough thank God you got the Charlotte squad, because when I was in the academy, I put a lot of cyber related stuff on my little form you have to fill out for what are you good at. And magically, same thing, Sunstars.
Probably got you to Charlotte.
Exactly, got me to Charlotte. And I even said, when I asked what squad am I on, I got a thing that said Squad 7 Cyber. I'm like, oh, that's cool. But but then I found out I was called the National Infrastructure Protection Center squad. I'm like, what the hell does that mean? I mean,
what is that?
When you go to a party and you say you're an FBI agent, they say, that's cool. What do you work? You say NIPSI. They're like, what the hell is that? So who came up with that idea, with that particular name? Come on.
Actually, Bill Clinton had a cyber czar.
Well, there you go.
So they knew they had to protect our critical infrastructures because they were all moving to cyber, right? Mm-hmm. And the power grid, water supply, energy, everything. So they knew we had a risk there because we could start to see it when some of the cases were getting in at FBI headquarters and that DOD was getting. And So, all right, well, we got to protect our national infrastructure. So that needs to go in the title. And we got to protect them. So that needs to go in the title. We need to have a center for it. And it's going to be a national thing. So they just kind of threw all those words together, and that's what they came out with. But that's where I was assigned at FBI headquarters. And it was a group of multi-agencies. So we had representatives from CIA, Secret Service, NSA, FBI. Everybody was working in one location inside FBI headquarters together to try to create this protection and give some guidance to the field on how to help them protect entities within their AOR. So that's where the name came from, Darren.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So while you're at headquarters, before we jump to Charlotte, you worked two big task force related cases, Solar Sunrise and Moonlight Maze, which were interesting. Yep. They were different but the same, because they both targeted DOD resources, correct? Among other things, they both got in the Pentagon. So talk a little bit about how that came to be, because why? So if I remember correctly, I'm basing this off of what I remember and what I've read, that when these two intrusions into the Pentagon and other agencies occurred, the headquarters put together a task force, correct? Probably under the NPSI banner, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And so was there a field office that ran these cases, or did headquarters run these cases?
So headquarters mainly ran the cases. I'll just say that, and would send out information and leads and stuff to the field. The field would collect the evidence and maintain that in their evidence room, but lots of direction was coming from headquarters, because this was a first, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of new stuff. Yeah, DOD was under attack. FBI got involved and worked with Air Force OSI, NCIS, and Army, CID, Army 92nd, and we were seeing these attacks, and it's much easier to track a cyber criminal down in your own country. So the first ones we tracked down were these two kids in California. They were in Cloverdale, California. We searched their house and interviewed them, and we found out that they were being taught by an Israeli, a guy named Ehud Tenenbaum. And Ehud was 18 at the time, and he was a year away from going into the Israeli army, because it's mandatory that everybody go into the army in Israel. So we had to hurry up and get to Israel before he went into the army, we thought, okay, or at least let them know. And so we, after arresting these two kids here in the U.S., we then focused on getting the information ready to take over to Israel. So we sent a team to Israel comprised of DOD agents from the various branches and FBI agent. And so they went over and spoke to the Israeli counterparts, and they arrested Tenenbaum, and they actually let us give them questions to ask him. And so, yeah, he was their teacher and trainer, and was kind of the one behind it. But that case brought to light the vulnerabilities that we have, not only in DOD, but in universities and the critical infrastructure. So it was a good basis of support for the NPSI.
So who had to go tell the Secretary of Defense that the Pentagon had been penetrated by two 17-year-old California kids and 18-year-old Israeli?
Yeah, that wasn't me. I don't know who had the pleasure of that job, but this case got a lot of attention. But it helped justify the NPSI for mm-hmm. sure, you know, why we needed to all work together. And it was a successful investigation. We got the ones responsible for it.
And then right on the heels of that was Moonlight Maze. And so talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Moonlight Maze.
I'm going to say the success was not quite as apparent in that one, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Moonlight Maze was huge. I ran the Moonlight Maze Task Force at headquarters. The task force consisted of like 25 people. And again, every branch of the military was represented: NASA, DOE, It was massive. We had intrusions happening at Air Force bases and Army Research Lab and Maryland. So Maryland had a big role. Cincinnati had a big role. We didn't know where these intrusions were coming from. So we started, you know, hopping back through. We would see them go through universities. At one point, they went through a hospital in Toronto. They went through a forestry site over in Canada. They maintained a drop site in the UK. So we had, when they go international, it slows everything down because you got to educate those folks how to do these things and what you're asking for and prove it to them and use their laws to try to get at what you wanted. Like, I wanted wiretaps on the hospital. I wanted wiretaps on the forestry service. I wanted wiretaps in UK, and Scotland Yard was fantastic. They had our drop site for all the stuff that was stolen out of the US. And so every day I would get on the phone at 7 a.m. East Coast time with Scotland Yard to find out what they steal last night. And when there was a large amount of data stolen, the fastest way to move that large amount of data in the mid to late 90s was put it on the Concorde jet and meet it at Dulles Airport. So Air Force OSI would run out to Dulles, meet the jet, and pick up the evidence and bring it down to headquarters. But we were seeing, we finally got connections, and from the UK site, it appeared to be going back to Russia. And again, we had intrusions at DOE labs. We had intrusions at NASA. At the time, the International Space Station was getting, you know, started, and lots of sharing was going on between the U.S. and Russia. And they were seeing, you know, users exceeding their authority at NASA. And then, of course, all the military sites were getting hit. Now, they were unclassified, but when you aggregate all the data that was stolen, you could at some point, if you did it in an organized fashion, it might become classified.
Sure.
So anyway, took a team to Moscow to see if they were being used as a firewall for another company. Are they just a pastor? And we got for the first couple of days, we had really good cooperation. They took us with them to their ISPs where we could see they were coming through or from. And then after determining, you know, the dial-up at those ISPs in Moscow, all cooperation just stopped.
The hell you say?
Yeah. So for the remainder of our time there, which they knew exactly how long we were staying, they would take us sightseeing.
Yeah, right.
The MVD would pick us up and take us to see beautiful sights in Moscow. And then we got on a plane and headed back with no results.
My guess is the tours ended with lunch with a lot of vodka being served.
Lots of vodka. Oh, goodness. Those little glasses on stems.
Yes, exactly.
If they were at your place, at the table,
yep,
you knew you were in for a rough time.
Yes, indeed. And heaven forbid you should empty that thing, because there was always a guy behind you ready to fill it back up.
Yes. Oh, yes. And the sequence of toasts.
Yes, you know, right, exactly. To your girlfriends and your wives and to your fallen comrades was always the third one. Everybody stood and did that. Yes.
Yep. Don't forget Mother Russia.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then the U.S. and
so my guess is no one ever was identified as the perpetrator of Moonlight Maze. Would I be correct in that?
That is correct.
So still, they're still out there. Ironically,
put the handcuffs on somebody.
that is unfortunate, but. At the end of the day, those were two fantastic cases, memorable in the cyber world, and it helped get you to Charlotte. So you get to Charlotte.
Yes.
How did they staff your squad? Let me ask that. I got there after you'd already had a couple people on it, but how did the Charlotte field office give you personnel?
So it was interesting, and they kind of looked for any volunteers that wanted to go initially, and you know, get a change of what their work and a different flavor of some other kind of investigative work. So I got a violent crime agent. I started looking for specialty transfers within the bureau, because sitting at headquarters, I was able to see who the really good people are. Across all the field. And I'm like, I want to stack my squad. And it's Charlotte. Who wouldn't want to come to Charlotte? So I got a few specialty transfers.
Ironically, those specialties, if I remember, they came from Baltimore, not all over the FBI, exactly. But they all came from Baltimore. Ironic how that happens.
Yeah, exactly. So, started getting some really good skilled people, and I got some new folks that had never done it before. And so we had get some training going, and the training for cyber was needed work. Okay. Yeah. Because we got all these new squads popping up and agents are staffing it that have never worked this type of case before. And so we need to get training and set up. And one of the cases we had in Charlotte was a wireless intrusion case, and we had no wireless training. So we asked specifically headquarters to get us a class, and Charlotte was the first squad mm-hmm. to get trained on how to work a wireless investigation. So we still were continuing to do a lot of first, even in Charlotte.
So what was it with Charlotte with Lowe's? Because the two big cases that we did there, I missed the first one, but I got there for the second one, which resulted in the wireless case. Was why was Lowe's always targeted?
You know, they were so different, the different cases
right.
For Lowe's, but we felt like we were Lowe's personal squad almost. as soon as I hit the ground in Charlotte in 1999, Lowe's was being extorted for money. You know, I forget now, $250,000, I think. I don't remember. Anyway. Some pipe bombs went off in Lowe's home improvement stores here in North Carolina. And, of course, again, this goes to the violent crime squad. And they started working it. And then Lowe's headquarters gets an extortion note, to when they're ready to meet the demands of the bomber, to put it on the bottom of their website, ready to meet demands. So the violent crime squad was like, holy crap, we got a new cyber crime squad. Get that cyber supervisor down here. We don't know what to do with this website. So my squad got involved at that point, and we started monitoring the website. Well, it was just massive amounts of hits. So it was very difficult to find out who might be checking that to see that we were ready to meet demands. We made it a hyperlink so that we could try and narrow down the volume of IP addresses. But that didn't work. And Lowe's got another demand note telling him where to wire the money. And it was going to a bank in Latvia. Well, when we got that note, we were able to trace, get a hold of the bank, find out how that account was set up, who was the owner of the account and that type of thing. And they said, oh, it's set up in a corporation's name. And it was set up via the internet. It was a Panamanian corporation, and we traced the Panamanian corporation was set up via the internet as well. So all this was via the internet, and we got some IP addresses from the bank and from the Panamanian corporation set up, and it was all going back to a Greensboro public library. And then the bomber got sloppy, and he got a new DSL line in his home, and he started checking everything from that. And so we were able to trace his account to his home. We got search warrants, and we were able to arrest him. But it was actually the cyber trail that led to the identification of the bomber. It was a really cool case because it mixed cyber with violent crime and bombings. And so because of that, that was a first. I got a call from Janet Reno wanting to know, hey, how'd you set your squad up to be so successful so quick? You know, we got to replicate this across the country. So that was good. And then the second Lowe's case was also a first. Three knuckleheads up in Michigan in the Detroit area were sitting in the parking lot of a Lowe's and hacking into through their Wi-Fi to get the software that would capture card swipes, credit and debit card swipes, at all of their point of sale machines. And we were able, with the help of Lowe's, track those knuckleheads down because they had taken the software from sitting in the parking lot, took it home, modified the code, went back, sat in the parking lot, uploaded the code to the mainframes, and compiled it, and then distributed it out to some stores. And so they knew what they were doing, and we caught two of them within 3 days, and they were mobile. They were in a car, and I'm talking to the Detroit agents. It was in November. It was cold. We were coming up on Veterans Day weekend, and I said, look, I can't tell you this isn't terrorism related. I don't know. It could be fundraising. They're looking for swipe information. And they're like, well, what are we looking for? I said, you look for cars in the parking lot with a laptop open, you know? Yeah. And so they did, and they found the car. They followed the car to a movie theater. There was laptops in the back, identified the owner, found the apartment where they lived. And then we looked on the web and found all kinds of good pictures of them having Wi-Fi access or good intercepts for Wi-Fi and big antennas and all kinds of good stuff. Anyway, we knew that was our bad guys. And executed a search warrant there in Detroit. And then there was a fight over who was going to prosecute it. Well, I said, well, the bad guys are up here in Detroit. We want to prosecute it. And we said, but Lowe's headquarters is here in Charlotte division. We want to prosecute. So we won that one because the example we gave was if Ford was hacked and our bad guys were down here in Charlotte and we arrested them here, would you want us prosecuting a case for Ford down here or would you want it back in Michigan? So we won that battle and we got to have the case down here.
Yeah, I remember that. The funniest thing about that case is you sent Scott Huntsberry there in a U-Haul van to get all the evidence, and he had to drive up there and come back.
Go get it.
Exactly.
Go get it.
Ironically,
take it out of their hands.
Right. When I went to headquarters, one of the supervisors I worked with there was Denise Steeman from Detroit, who did the she did the search warrant for that case.
Yep.
Yeah. And she said that the reason they found them in the parking lot is one of the agents had to go to the bathroom when he's walking into Lowe's to use it, and he walked by the car with the laptop open, and that's how they identified the car.
It was perfect. Yeah. Yep.
So sadly, what happens in Charlotte is Robert Mueller, who, if you talk to people in Washington, probably loved him as an FBI agent. If you talk to FBI agents, I mean, as an FBI director, if you talk to FBI agents, they didn't care much for Robert Mueller as an FBI director, but that's perhaps for another podcast. But he decides to create the worst policy in the history of the FBI, the 5-year up and out, which impacted you and made you have to step down off the squad that you helped create and build from nascency. So you ended up finishing your career in counterintelligence. So in that role, because at this time, the only reason I ever went to FBI headquarters is because you were no longer my supervisor. If 5-year up and out never occurs, I probably stay in Charlotte for my whole career, which my kids would have loved, but you know, they don't mind Huntsville either. But so you end up in counterintelligence. Did you start to see the blending of cyber and CI threats during your time there? What did that look like to you as you obviously being probably having more experience than anybody in the FBI with cyber, and now you work in CI. Did you see those two threats coming together?
Absolutely. During my time from going from having one SSA at FBI headquarters for cybercrime to where we were when I worked, when I was on the squad here in Charlotte, and then moving over to CI, the cyber tentacles and crime were reaching every one of the things that the FBI investigates, whether it was violent crime or drugs, or in this case that we're talking about here, counterintelligence. It was cyber was a piece of every one. And I remember discussions with headquarters, just like, and this is how Innocent Images got moved from violent crime to cyber division and back to VICMO, is we need all of our expertise because we don't have a lot of it in one place, and then let them handle everything related to that. Well, then as our numbers grew and we trained more people on how to work cyber, then we said, okay, we can move that back out to where it really belongs, whether it was like Innocent Images going back to violent crime or fraud, cyber fraud going to white collar, because now we've got enough people that we can put our resources into the different programs and different squads and have the skill set on that squad to work cyber piece of that component. And So yeah, going to CI, I was actually recruited from when I had to step down. I actually got 7 years because the policy came in later after I got on the desk. And so I was recruited by the CI supervisor. So I went over there and I said, you know, this is really cool. He said, we want your cyber background. You ran the squad. You had big cases at headquarters you managed. So we need your expertise here. And so, yeah, there were a lot of different instances where we could see, you know, especially into the cleared defense contractor arena where state-sponsored hacking was occurring in the state of North Carolina and stealing technology that DOD absolutely said could not be stolen. And they were even put insiders. I know cases of insiders have been prosecuted in the Middle District of North Carolina because this is the way to steal stuff. But if you can't hack in and steal it, then that's when you would need an insider to be placed in there, right? Mm-hmm. So it definitely is in every one of the programs that the FBI investigates. There's a cyber nexus to just about every case.
That's right. So now you ultimately retire from the FBI and you move to Mandiant, which is now FireEye. So let's give your current employer some publicity if you ever read cyber news, you always see two names always pop up. FireEye and CrowdStrike are the two big companies you see up. So what's FireEye's specialty, and what is your role in building what they do?
Okay, so I took my FBI expertise into FireEye, but FireEye is a cybersecurity company based out of Milpitas, California. I had worked in my role in the FBI as a cyber supervisor. I worked with Kevin Mandia, who's the CEO of FireEye, prior CEO of Mandiant before it was bought out by FireEye. And so I knew Kevin a long time before I retired. Anyway, FireEye has hardware, software to detect and prevent cyber attacks. Love that. I still feel like I'm fighting a good fight, even though I don't have a badge and gun anymore. And we have the Mandiant side, which does investigations for companies and organizations that have been breached. Mm. And so I started with Mandiant on their intelligence team because I finished my career in counterintelligence. Seemed like a nice fit. Sure. And what I was doing there was working victim notifications, which is no different than what the FBI does. So when the FBI knows that, you know, a company specifically in the clear defense contractor arena have been hacked or breached, they notify them and try, you know, work a case usually. So from the private sector, we still do the same thing. When we know an organization or company's been breached, we will notify them and let them know. We don't make it salesy. We just say, here's your data. Here's what you can do about it. If you need our help, we're here. If you don't, that's fine too. So I started doing that. And then after a year of being at FireEye, I was asked to start a new program where we would put an embedded FireEye analyst on site with a government agency. So we started working with a lot of governments around the globe, where we would place our analysts in with their team to share what FireEye knew about the threat to them. I ran that for 5 years. And last year, I moved back to victim notifications where I am now. And I've been here another year and a half. So I've come full circle. And we're notifying a lot of victims, especially Darren right now with ransomware on the rampage.
Yep.
We have been doing a lot of notifications on ransomware that we see from our collection where they're setting up, staging, getting ready to encrypt and so forth and installing backdoors and sometimes even start a lateral movement. So we can notify them and ahead of time to try to prevent their data from getting encrypted. And it's so sad. We're seeing a lot of hospitals being hit, nursing homes, retirement communities. And the reason is the bad guys have said they will pay quick because of COVID.
Yep. Yeah.
So
it's crazy.
That's so sad.
Yeah. The small hospital that was in the town where I grew up in upstate New York got hit with one of these variants, and it was so bad that they couldn't open the doors because the locking mechanism for the doors were embedded in their computer systems and the doors were locked. They couldn't unlock them. So, and yeah. I only know this because a friend of mine runs the company that puts in those doors. So they had to send people to the hospitals to clip wires just so they could open the doors to get people into the different regions. Crazy. So I'm going to ask, I really appreciate your time. We could go on and on with different cases in Charlotte and stuff we did, but so I'm going to ask you the last question I ask everybody, just because I think the answer is interesting. But if you go back in time, what are you going to tell your 13-year-old self?
Oh, live life to the fullest and make a difference by helping others, because life is short.
Mm-hmm. And stay in Charlotte, right?
And stay in Charlotte. You can get to Charlotte from wherever you are.
Yeah. Well, Doris, I very much appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. I want to wish you and your family a happy Thanksgiving. And like I said, you were the best boss I ever had in the FBI, and it was an honor working for you.
Darren, you're an awesome agent, and thank you for taking time for this interview. It was a lot of fun to recap some memories.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
As always, I want to thank you for listening. If you have any questions you'd like me to address on future podcasts or topics you'd like to hear, please email me at darren@thecyberguy.com. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R. You can find this podcast at all the usual spots. So if you like what you hear, tell your friends, have them go on and listen to the podcast. You can get them at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and so on. If you're so inclined, leave a review and tell your friends. As you progress through your week, make sure you understand the threats that are targeting you, assess your risk overall. Make sure you proceed wisely. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Thanks for listening.